Police say an Uber car dropped off Nicholas Cruz at his former high school in South Florida around 2:19 p.m. on Wednesday. Within 10 minutes, authorities say he had killed 17 people. It is where we begin Week in Review on this Friday. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Arvina Martin is a member of the Madison Common Council and former chair of the American Indian Caucus for the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. Arvina, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And Rick Essenberg is president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Rick, welcome to you.
Good morning, Kate. Good morning, Arvina, and thank you for having me on the show.
So 19-year-old Nicholas Jacob Cruz shot and killed 17 people. He has been charged with premeditated murder. We'll get to your thoughts on the shooting, then move into the call for action by lawmakers. Arvina, you first. What do you make of this?
Unfortunately, these seem to be happening a lot. You know, we've heard that this is quite possibly the 19th shooting of the year. We're not even 2 whole months into the year. And it's absolutely devastating. It's devastating that this took place at a school, that there were so many lives lost, so many kids and teachers and people that work at schools that just want to educate, and they're not here anymore. And that's, to me, absolutely devastating.
Rick, how about you? What was your reaction?
Well, you know, I think this is the second time that I've been on the show after one of these shootings. I think I was on the Las Vegas shooting.
You were, yes.
It's frustrating because, you know, this, generally speaking, this is a time in which gun violence has gone down over, say, the past 15 to 20 years. And although the claim that, there have been 18 school shootings is a junk statistic, which has been, you know, debunked. The fact of the matter is mass shootings have gone up. And so it's natural for us to want to know what we can do to stop them. My hope, and as I think I've expressed before on your show, is that we not use this as a way to bash each other, that we tone down the conversation and we talk civilly and we talk specifically about what it is that we propose to do that we think may have an impact on these things.
Well, regardless of the number there have been, clearly, you know, this is an issue. President Trump addressed the nation yesterday from the White House and said no child should have to go to school fearing for their lives. He says he'll go to Florida and meet with the victims' families, explore how to better secure schools, and then tackle the difficult issue of mental health. Missing from his remarks were any mention of guns and gun control. Rick, with this question, when this question comes up with virtually every mass shooting in the U.S., is this a mental health issue, or do we need tougher gun control laws, or is it a mixture of both?
Well, you know, the problem is that all solutions have a cost. Like, some people emphasize security, that we should have armed guards at all schools and soft targets. The cost of doing that might well be prohibitive. Some people rightly emphasize mental health issues, and I think that that's important. But it's very, very difficult to know how you're going to identify people who are going to do these things, and then what you would do in response to that that wouldn't itself present due process problems. When you talk about gun control, you have to sort of begin with the proposition that in the United States we have a Second Amendment, and we have roughly 300 million guns in circulation. And so the notion that we would confiscate or ban the private ownership of guns is simply a non-starter in the United States for a lot of reasons. It's politically impossible, it's constitutionally impermissible, and it's probably pragmatically impossible. And so at that point, we start to talk about the particular proposals that have been made to change the gun laws. And for the most part, we find that it wouldn't have much impact on, or any impact, really, on any of these incidents. Marco Rubio, a couple of years ago, claimed that no gun law proposals would have any impact on any of these mass shootings. The Washington Post fact-checked him on that, the Washington Post, Hartley, New York, and the National Rifle Association, and concluded that he was right. However, having said that, I would say again that if you want to talk about gun control, let's talk about gun control. but let's not bang on about the NRA rather, and bang on about people who supposedly don't care about this. Everybody cares about this. Let's talk about specific proposals. And when you talk about specific proposals, you can't simply talk about assault weapons. That's a conclusion. That's not a description. You have to talk about what is it that specifically you think we should do that would decrease the probability that things like this happen. And when you do that, but only when you do that, we can begin to have a conversation.
House Speaker Paul Ryan was asked yesterday if authorities should be able to take away guns from mentally ill people. Let's take a listen.
This is not the time to jump to some conclusion, not knowing the full facts. We've got a lot of more information we need to know. But if someone who is mentally ill is slipping through the cracks and getting a gun, because we have laws on the books, we have a system to prevent people who aren't supposed to get guns from getting guns. And if there are gaps there, then we need to look at those gaps.
So, Arvina, do we need to be better at enforcing existing laws, or are there gaps? Are current laws inadequate?
Well, excuse me. Just last February, President Trump signed a bill into law that rescinded a lot of the Obama-era background checks, in terms of people who may have problems with mental illness. He took that away. So that's gone. And that just happened last year. That would be something that we could do. We could put these back in to play, make our background checks more thorough. You know, about 90% of Americans believe that we should have more thorough background checks. But unfortunately, the NRA, the lobbying arm, is more interested in protecting the profit margins of gun manufacturers than they are of protecting the interest of gun owners, who, again, 74% of NRA members are in favor of background checks. This should be easy to do.
Let's bring in Camille now, who joins us from New Berlin. Hi, Camille.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I think that when you talk about as of October 2017, Paul Ryan has received nearly $172,000in contributions from the NRA and $342,000 from gun lobbyists, that if you say, as one of your guests did, that we can't talk about the NRA when we're talking about these cases, we are severely limiting the discussion, and unfairly.
Rick Essenberg, your response?
Well, there's a lot of inaccuracy that infects this conversation. For example, this claim that, you know, the Trump administration took away background checks. Absolutely false. What they did was they rolled back a Trump or an Obama-era regulation that prevented gun sales from people who were receiving Social Security disability payments. Now, it's possible that some of them could be receiving disability payments because of a mental health problem. But to suggest that, you know, this repeal background checks is simply false. I mean, we still have background checks by a gun. People say we have a gun show loophole. We don't have a gun show loophole. We have a loophole for private gun transactions. If a licensed firearm dealer wants to sell a gun at a gun show, he's got to do a background check. Now, should we have background checks for private transactions? I'm open to having that conversation. We have to figure out how that would work. I don't think it would be a silver bullet, because when we're talking about people who are buying guns to commit a crime, private transactions would be very, very difficult to detect and control. But when you get to the point where you say, okay, let's see if we can put in a place a system to have background checks for private transactions, that's a concrete conversation that we can have. But once again, you know, just talking about the NRA and who gets money from the NRA, and the NRA is, you know, really, when you look at, you know, all the organizations that give money to politicians, the NRA actually isn't among the top funders. I just don't think that adds much light. That just generates heat. Let's talk about specifics.
Joshua in Madison would hopefully like to go to specifics. Joshua, hi.
Hi. Yeah, so your male guest, he immediately tried to pivot away from talking about things that we can do and saying that they're nonsensical and they won't work. And I guess my point is, we're not a nation in a bubble. We're a nation among nations that have done gun laws that have had similar problems in the past. And by passing stricter gun laws, they've curbed mass shootings. And it just seems to me, I mean, there's things that we can do. I mean, my God, bump stocks. We still have bump stocks. You know, I'm a hunter, so I don't need somebody telling me that of what can work and what doesn't and what's impractical and what's not practical. You know, if you can't hit something with more than five shots, then you have no business having a weapon.
Joshua, thank you so much. I want to bring in another voice to the conversation, Democrat Chris Murphy of Connecticut, who's become a leading figure in the push for gun control legislation, was on the Senate floor as the reports of the shooting started coming out on Wednesday, and he says it's not because of coincidence or bad luck that these mass shootings only happen in America, but because Congress hasn't taken any action. Let's listen.
As a parent, it scares me to death that this body doesn't take seriously the safety of my children. And it seems like a lot of parents in South Florida are going to be asking that same question later today. We pray for the families, for the victims. We hope for the best.
Other Democrats have called for expanded background checks and a committee to study gun violence. Arvina, what do you want lawmakers to do?
I want lawmakers to allow the CDC to be able to study gun violence. That is something that I believe about 20 years ago was banned. This is important. We need to have the information. If, as Mr. Eisenberg suggests, that we need to have data, we need to understand the sources, we need to be able to study it. This is a health crisis. Our children are being killed. People are being killed all over the place. And it's scary. We need to be able to understand what's happening.
Let's bring in another Rick voice here. Rick in Park Falls, before we go back to Rick Eisenberg. Rick, go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Back in the 1990s, Hillary and Bill Clinton passed the Clinton assault weapon ban law, which was 460 pages of very dense federal legislation. It was a bewildering blizzard of regulations, and yet I don't think it had any statistically demonstrable effect on crime in America whatsoever. This is a cultural problem that needs to be attacked from a cultural standpoint. And one of the first things we have to do is to dethrone these left-wing elites who have created all of these problems, including the Great Recession.
Rick, thanks for the call. Rick Eisenberg, laws can't solve the problem. What do you make of that? You're a lawyer.
Sometimes law can, sometimes law can't. You know, the devil is always in the details. You know, we have this claim that these mass shootings don't happen in any other country. Barack Obama said that when he was president. The Washington Post fact-checked him on that. They found that he's wrong. They do happen in other countries. In fact, depending on slice and dice statistics, the per capita rate of violence for mass shootings is higher in some countries than it actually is here. We can argue about whether that's a good way to look at the number or not. But look, I run a think tank. I'm all for studying things, and I'm all for having serious discussions about what works. The caller who said that I'm not open to any type of reform mentioned bump stocks. I know when I was on the show after the Las Vegas shooting, I think we reached common agreement that, you know, bump stocks are probably something that we shouldn't have. It's illegal to own an automatic weapon for the most part in the United States of America. It doesn't make much sense, but people sell things that will convert a semi-automatic weapon to an automatic weapon. But I think that's the kind of conversation that we have to have. But unfortunately, what we do in these circumstances is we all retreat to the hustings, right? We all sort of get together with our tribe, and our first impulse is to say that the people on the other side are sort of evil or they're corrupt or they don't care about this problem. And I think that that's not true. I think everybody cares about this problem. They have different assessments about what it is that we should do in response to it. And the only way that we can navigate those differences we have is to stop calling each other names, stop accusing each other of having bad motives, and talk about specific and concrete proposals.
Lots of engagement on this. Let's go to Dave in Madison. Hi, Dave. Your thoughts?
Hi. I think the approach needs to look at the gun manufacturers and the fact that they have this immunity from lawsuits. That means that they don't have to improve their product. If their product gets sold to psychotic killers, that means they will generate more gun sales.
How do you see they have immunity?
If we took away their immunity from being sued, we could sue them with a class action lawsuit saying you have a defective product that can be used by someone who's not the owner. It's capable of being modified, and it could murder, you know, dozens of people, so that makes it defective.
Dave, thanks for that. And Arvina, before we get back to you, let's get the lawyer involved here. Rick Essenberg, what do you make of that?
It's unusual to say that a product is defective because someone can use it intentionally to commit a crime. This is really another way of, you know, attempting to impose on gun manufacturers an obligation to make their product essentially something that you know, is designed in some way. If it was possible to do that, I don't see how it would. It would make it impossible for anybody to actually use it in a way that they ought not to be using it under the law. And I think that there may be things that about around that issue that can be worthwhile discussing, but litigation and courtrooms are probably not the place to have that conversation because they generally involve making trade-offs about costs, and it's much better to have that happen in the legislature than have it happen in a courtroom where you don't have the same type of broad public input into what the rules should be.
Arvina, how likely is it that Congress takes up significant gun legislation as a result of this shooting in Florida, or won't we see it?
I'm hopeful that this discussion will finally take place and that there will be meaningful changes. I'm not optimistic that it will happen, though, unfortunately. After the Las Vegas shootings, you know, we've heard it brought up today, bump stocks. Everybody's against them. Everybody said, yes, we should ban these. They're still legal. That had wide consensus, bipartisan, and nothing happened. After the Las Vegas shootings, mm-hmm. Those are still legal. You know, we need to make sure this goes through the legislative process, but we need to have all tools available to us. And if that means using the court system to help, put responsibility on the gun manufacturers. I mean, the AR-15 and that AR-15 type rifle is the most popular rifle to be used in shootings like this for many reasons. You know, it's lightweight. It has the recoil isn't super fierce or whatever the adjective you'd use to describe it. And they're very customizable. You know, what kind of regulations could be put into place to make these rifles less customizable? You know, and perhaps that would help as well.
You are with us on Week in Review as we pick apart the developments of the week, the mass shooting in Florida, across the nation, close to home. Arvina Martin is a member of the Madison Common Council and former chair of the American Indian Caucus for the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. Rick Essenberg is with us, president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. You can join in as well at 800-642-1234. Moving on to state issues, are you perhaps happy that state lawmakers are fast-tracking a plan to close Lincoln Hills Youth Prison, or are they moving too fast? How do you feel about an alcohol czar to oversee the state's beer, wine, and alcohol laws? Call in or tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, the state assembly was a busy place yesterday. Lawmakers passed a full slate of Governor Walker's welfare initiatives, including seeking federal help to pay for almost $90 million in costs from the proposals. We're tracking the legislative movement this week on Week in Review. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. At the table today is Rick Essenberg, President and General Counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, and Arvina Martin is here, a member of the Madison Common Council and former chair of the American Indian Caucus for the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the legislative priorities set forth by Governor Walker and how the legislature is responding to them? Who are you backing for state Supreme Court justice and why? Join in the conversation or tweet us at WPR Mornings. So a busy day in the Assembly yesterday, number of proposals seeing action. There was a public hearing before the Corrections Committee on a bill that would close the Lincoln Hills Youth Prison by July 2020 and move inmates to smaller regional facilities around the state that would be run by counties for the most part. And then moments later, the committee passed the measure unanimously, setting up a vote in the full Assembly next week. But then Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald says he's not sure if it'll pass. He called it a heavy lift. Rick, overall, what do you make of this movement and this idea?
I don't pretend to be an expert on, you know, everything that happened at the Lincoln Hills Correctional Facility other than to know that it seemed to be an institution that got out of control. In light of that, it seems like closing it is probably a good idea. Replacing it with smaller centers probably sounds like a good idea. I've heard that having sort of low-level offenders housed by counties will be less expensive. The county association seems to be not so sure about that. I don't know the answer. And, you know, your initial reaction is to say this seems like it's going in the right direction. It appears to have true bipartisan support, which is something we don't see very often in the legislature. And so it's hard to know what to make of that. Sometimes bipartisan support means that it's a good pragmatic compromise. Sometimes it means that both parties are, you know, getting their worst impulses satisfied. I'm a little sympathetic to Fitzgerald's statement that, you know, we ought to make sure that all of this works. Unfortunately, you know, it always seems that the legislature is trying to rush to pass things, and it's hard to do that. But
well, there was also some trepidation. Yeah, there was trepidation out there saying, you know, we don't want to repeat any past mistakes. We want to do this right. And there was that concern out there. Is that legitimate?
Well, I think it's always legitimate to worry about not repeating past mistakes. It's always legitimate to worry about not overreacting to whatever has just happened. As somebody who doesn't purport to be an expert in this, this seems to be moving to the right direction. Shutting the place down seems to be the right thing to do. Moving to smaller facilities seems to be the right thing to do. It might be that having these offenders housed in counties will be less expensive, but, I hope, and I guess I have to trust, that the legislature has taken into account the concerns of the counties and the economics of doing that, and have come to the conclusion that it's a practical solution.
Well, let's bring Arvina in here. Arvina, nobody testified against the bill during the hearing, although lobbyists for the Wisconsin Counties Association expressed concerns about this aggressive timeline and what the plan may cost counties. The idea Governor Walker called for has the state managing these regional prisons. Do you share those concerns or not so much?
Well, I think it would be fabulous if we had more time to work on this and make sure that everything is right. We do need to make sure, and our legislature and folks that are running these facilities, they need to make sure that they are going about things in the proper manner. Unfortunately, because we are coming to the end of the legislative session for the summer, time is short. And there needs to be something done. And we need to be able to protect the safety of both inmates as well as prison staff in locations like Lincoln Hills. And so closing it seems to be the prudent thing, as Mr. Essenberg suggested it as well, because this does have broad bipartisan support, because there hasn't been anyone up in arms about this. It seems to be a pretty good decision to make.
Well, before we move on to the next topic, let's bring in Jim from Lake Geneva on this. Jim, go ahead.
We're talking about Lincoln Hills, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I worked for corrections for over 25 years and 30 years for the state, and I was always working blue-collar jobs, even though I have two college degrees and some tech degrees. But the problem with Lincoln Hills started in 83 when I started with corrections. The people at the State Academy, then we had one academy, said, don't go to Lincoln Hills because you're going to be a punching bag and you're going to be punching kids, and I didn't want anything to do with that. So they basically, for staff-wise, they attracted local people who didn't want to move out of their area to get a job. They kept the pay a little lower, and the training was terrible. But the problem with corrections has always been management. And with Act 10, educated people, or just, you know, just smart people, were kept out of the decision-making process at all correctional levels. So
Jim, what do you make of this proposal on the table then? That
ridiculous, quite ridiculous. They should refurbish Ethan Allen, bring it up to good standards, and put them there, and put the worst of the worst there. The rest can go to county facilities, and the counties can take care of it, or they can create some minimum camps for juveniles that have proven that they are not a threat to others or the public. But it's ridiculous to spread these all over. Most of the people come from the square. And when I say the square, I'm talking Madison, Milwaukee, Janesville, Kenosha, Racine. The majority of these juveniles come from these urban areas. And when you move them up north, it just makes everything worse.
Jim, I'm going to have to cut you off there. So sorry. Thank you so much for calling in with your personal perspective. We need to move on. The Assembly signed off on increasing work requirements for food stamp recipients. Under their plan, able-bodied adults would have to work 30 hours a week, up from 20 under current law, and impose the requirement on parents for the first time. The Assembly voted along party lines. Speaker Robin Voss said this bill and others targeting welfare recipients are designed to get more people into the workforce. Democrats call them an election year gimmick to fire up the Republican base. Arvina, what are we going to see happen here in Wisconsin if these new work requirements become law?
You know, I worry about the effect on families, on working families that need this assistance in order to survive and to get back on their feet. You know, a lot of folks that are parents who don't work or more than 20 hours do so not because they don't want to, but because childcare is so unaffordable and that it makes more financial sense for them to be home with their children when their children are at home as well. So during the school day, perhaps they can work, but it becomes prohibitively expensive to provide care for their children. And it just puts parents of children that are in these situations in a really tough situation, and they have to make this difficult choice. And so forcing these extra hours when perhaps the assumption is they just don't want to work. No, it's likely because they can't afford childcare.
Rick, the bill now goes to the Senate, where they are also expecting it to pass. Will these changes lead to more working people?
Well, generally, work requirements do lead to more working people. I mean, we saw that with welfare reform in Wisconsin. I think the Democrats would do well not to be so reflexively opposed to this, because, I mean, I think there are two things that are going on here. First of all, I agree that it has to be implemented properly. I mean, you don't want to do something which will actually wind up costing the taxpayers more money. And certainly there are people who are not in a position to go to work, and you have to have some type of provision for that. But when you go to the public at large and you say, look, we want to provide assistance to people who need it, we're going to require them to work, however, in exchange for that assistance, most people will say, yeah, that seems like a fair thing to do, and I'm more likely to support that program because people are being required to work in exchange for what they get. Second, it is, I think, better for the recipients often to have a job than to simply stay at home and not work. It not only does it help them economically, or can help them economically, but it also helps their sense of well-being and their ability to integrate into society as productive members. So while I agree that the thing has to be implemented properly, and it's probably not the case that you can require absolutely everyone to work, it's the concept itself has merit, both in terms of generating support for the program and, I think, for truly serving the people who are intended to benefit by the program. And so I think when you sort of reflexively say that these folks are being targeted, I think you're missing a lot of what's going on.
Well, Matt in Wausau emailed, said, quote, "Now Wisconsin can be counted among the cruelest states relative to welfare. We have a process in place in that subsidizes food like milk and cheese, but these subsidies don't seem to make a policy change. No one should starve here or be humiliated for needing food." So, Matt, they're critical of what he sees going on in terms of what is called these welfare reform initiatives. Rick, actually, let's move on here. We have so much ground to cover. And moving on to the alcohol czar, which over in the Senate, the Committee on Economic Development, Commerce, and Local Government held a hearing yesterday on a bill that would create a so-called alcohol czar. This person would have broad powers to enforce state laws and regulations governing the production, distribution, and sale of beer, wine, and alcohol. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald introduced the bill just 2 days earlier. He said the state is not properly enforcing liquor laws. So, Rick, does Wisconsin need an alcohol czar?
No. We're in the last days of the legislative session, and everything sort of moves at breakneck speed. And sometimes, as Arvinia pointed out, you have to do that because you have to get things done. But sometimes you have to watch the legislature carefully, because this is where they do things that they really ought not to do. And so when you talk about having an alcohol czar to enforce alcohol laws, I mean, we're not talking about keeping alcohol away from minors. We're not talking about, targeting drunk driving. We're talking about ways to bolster the three-tier system. And the three-tier system says that, you've got manufacturers, you've got wholesalers, and you've got retailers, and basically they all have to stay in their separate lanes. And the effect of that is to devolve a great deal of power on wholesalers and to seriously disadvantage craft brewers, beer pubs, wineries, these type of sort of innovative and very popular ways that, people have to enjoy craft beverages because, wholesalers tend to disadvantage those, or the laws sort of work in a way that their business models don't work. And so it seems to me that what we really need to do is, we don't need to have an alcohol czar. We need to reform the three-tier system, and we need to make sure that what laws we have are limited to protecting the public safety and not protecting the business interests of, people who participate in the alcohol industry, and particularly the wholesalers. And so I think this law moves in exactly the wrong direction. What we really need to do is go back to Dale Coenga's bill to reform the three-tier system. That's where we're really going to benefit the public, and not by appointing some type of alcohol czar.
Arvinia, would Wisconsin be better off with or without this alcohol czar?
I tend to agree with Mr. Eisenberg. I don't think it's a necessary thing for Wisconsin. I think that it would be burdensome, again, for the same reasons, to our local craft breweries as well as craft distilleries. These are parts of our economy that are growing, and we have a lot of these local establishments that either brew or distill their own spirits or beer, and they're doing well. We don't need to be hindering them, that this is being pushed forward again in the waning days of the legislative session. It's a little hinky, maybe not, that the lobbyist that just signed on to support this bill is Senator Fitzgerald's brother. I mean, it doesn't quite pass the smell test.
And we're going to break right there. You're with us on Weekend Review. On Capitol Hill yesterday, senators failed to advance a bipartisan proposal to resolve the future of millions of young undocumented immigrants, leaving talks basically back at square one. Much anticipated bipartisan effort failed to get the votes necessary. We're talking about it on Weekend Review. Rick Essenberg is president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. And Arvina Martin is member of the Madison Common Council and former chair of the American Indian Caucus for the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. How would you like to see Congress settle the immigration debate on Dreamers and border security? Which political issue in the news do you want to discuss this week? What was on your radar? Join in at 800-642-1234. Send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Back in just a moment on the Ideas Network. You are with us on Week in Review. Arvina Martin is a member of the Madison Common Council, former chair of the American Indian Caucus for the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. Rick Essenberg is here as well, president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, or WILL. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How should Congress solve the immigration impasse? Would you call it an impasse? What caught your attention this week? Who are you backing for state Supreme Court justice and why? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Arvina, I know you were talking in today about the Supreme Court justice primary, since that is coming up Tuesday, and you were mentioning it as you were coming in the studio here. Your thoughts on the candidates on the ballot first?
I think that both Tim Burns and Rebecca Dollett would be excellent choices for our Supreme Court. They are both people that seem to be fair-minded and would be a great addition to our ever-growing conservative Supreme Court. The other opponent is backed by the NRA, and I think that that is, especially considering the events of the last week, is kind of scary.
So Tim Burns, who's been the most outspokenly liberal, Milwaukee County Circuit Judge Rebecca Dollett, who's been trying to portray herself as more of a moderate while still aiming at some of Burns' supporters, and Sauk County Circuit Court Judge Michael Scrinock, who is the backing of conservatives. Rick, what stands out to you in this primary field?
Yeah, what stands out to me is that this is a pretty unusual campaign that's being run by, in particular, Tim Burns, but also I think to some degree by Rebecca Dollett. Scrinock is running a fairly conventional campaign. He talks about the rule of law. He talks about the role of the courts. Burns and Dollett talk about their political values. Now, Burns is off the chart when it comes to this. I mean, he's running ads attacking Scott Walker. He's talking about how, somehow on the bench he's going to, go after the rigged economy. I mean, he's running as if he were a candidate for the United States Senate and not a candidate for the judiciary. And Dollett is a little bit more toned down in this, but she keeps talking about her values, and her values turn out to be her position on contested political issues, like the Affordable Care Act and the Great Lakes Restoration Project, and she doesn't like Donald Trump, and she wants to take on the racial and patriarchal system. These are all, perfectly valid things for people to have opinions on, but normally we don't think that they are bases on which judges should decide cases. Like, judges are supposed to decide cases on the law, and oftentimes it will require them to rule in ways which are inconsistent with their political values. I think that what we're seeing here is that this is a February 20th primary. The turnout is very low. The turnout tends to consist of, the bases of both political parties and, people who, tend to have the strongest opinions. And, Dollett and Burns are fighting over signaling to the Democratic base which one of them is the most woke and the most far to the left.
Well, let's bring
doing it in a way which we normally don't see in these judicial races.
Let's bring in some calls here. Sylvia in Baraboo weighing in. Hi, Sylvia.
Oh, good morning. Yes, I am for Tim Burns. I think he has come from modest means. He is, and he will continue to work for our working families, and that's what he will base his, probably his things on. And we need someone that is other than those that are already there.
Sylvia, thanks for the call. Let's go to Kim in Waupun. Hi, Kim. Your thoughts?
Hi, thank you. I'm voting for Tim Burns because of his stance of fighting corporations and fighting for us, the people. And that's who I'm voting for, is Tim Burns.
Kim, so two there. Arvina, do you sense a turnout here for a primary that might be larger than normal?
I think the stage is set for a larger than normal turnout. We saw the special election in Senate District 10, which elected now Senator Schachner. They weren't expecting the turnout that they got. I think that the way our political climate is at the moment, I think people want to have their voices heard. And I think that voting in these elections are a way for them to do that. A lot of people feel very disempowered right now at things that are happening at all levels of government. And I think that participating in this process, we're going to have a lot more people than we expect. I don't think this is going to be a standard year for primaries and general elections.
Do you think similarly there, Rick, turnout-wise?
I mean, you know, it's hard to say.
Okay.
I have not heard of any recent polling. I did hear reports of some polling that had taken place in December, and the number that I heard was that there were 72% of the electorate were undecided. And when you have 72% undecided, what that means is probably most of them won't vote. The turnout in these February elections is usually pretty small, around 10%. And whether or not this will be higher under these circumstances, I don't know. I'm sort of amused, and I can't help but say this. I'm sort of amused when people talk about, you know, Tim Burns fighting against corporations and for working families, and he talks about himself as a consumer lawyer. He's an insurance coverage lawyer who works for the Perkins Coie law firm. I guarantee you there's no working family in the United States. There's no upper middle class family in the United States that could ever afford the hourly rates of Perkins Coie.
Well, let's move on to the next issue, a couple of national issues. Arvina, the Senate has started voting on rival immigration proposals, a bipartisan proposal to protect 1.8 million Dreamers from deportation and direct the government to gain better control of the U.S.-Mexico border. It needed 60 votes to pass, did not pass. That measure did not give the Dreamers a pathway to citizenship and didn't explicitly provide the $25 billion for the border. Earlier in the day, Trump threatened to veto the measure. Did this bill warrant some consideration?
Well, I think that, again, with a looming deadline for the Dreamers, that there needs to be a lot of work being put into these particular immigration bills. That deadline is approaching rapidly. We have, there were four separate bills. The authors need to come together and really work on a compromise that can provide a path to citizenship and provide that security for children who have come to this country because their parents brought them. This is their home. This is where they live. This is their American. This is the land that they know. And we need to make sure that we are working really hard to protect them.
Rick, the Senate also rejected President Trump's proposal, which helps Dreamers, provides the border security money, and he wants to clamp down on restrictions on legal immigration. So what happens now? There's a lot of fuzziness in this.
Well, yeah, it's sort of amusing in that, you know, the proposal that President Trump made sort of belies the notion that he's some kind of nativist. If he would have said that this is what he was going to do in the primaries, he probably would have lost a lot of his immigration restrictionist support. You know, there's a clear path, I think, to a resolution here. You have to understand that the public has come to believe that the government is very, very good at granting amnesties and not enforcing the law, but it's not very good at securing the border. And I think the public wants to help, you know, people who were brought into the country legally as children and who have lived here for many years. They truly want to do that. But they're also concerned that at the same time we do something so these very, very difficult situations don't keep coming up. And so if you're going to grant what is, in effect, an amnesty, then you need to also, at the same time, do something which makes future amnesties less likely to happen. And so it seems to me that there's a way to do this. There's a way to grant to relief to people who are in a very difficult situation. But you have to combine that with serious measures to assure the public that we're not going to be in the same place 5, 10, 15 years down the road. And right now we just don't have a critical mass of Democrats and Republicans who are willing to accept that reality. We've got to accept that reality. I mean, it's time to sort of step up and move forward on this.
Well, jetting off across the world to the Winter Olympics, also in the news, of course, this week, kicking off last weekend in South Korea, Vice President Mike Pence was there at the opening ceremony, found himself at the center of political controversy. He opted not to stand when the unified North and South Korean team walked together. A spokesman for him tweeted that the vice president would rather stand and cheer for U.S. athletes than recognize the most oppressive regime on earth. Those are quotes. Some columnists call Pence a hypocrite for walking out of an NFL game last year after several players refused to stand for the national anthem. Arvina, does it matter that the vice president sat for the Korean team?
I think that sitting perhaps is a very good way to show someone's displeasure or someone's disapproval of the way something operates. I think that, you know, he sat down for them, for the Korean delegation, which was both North and South Korea, because of his ill feelings towards the North Korean government. I just wish that he could see that some people in this country feel strongly about the way they are being treated by their own country and have that same kind of desire to show their displeasure in a way that's not violent, in a way that's not, and they're doing something peacefully. And that's kind of the way we should be protesting these things.
Rick, what do you see on the optics of this and what the vice president did?
I mean, I think the media shamed itself. We can have our domestic political differences, and I certainly have been very critical of President Trump when I thought he wanted to and didn't support him for the nomination. But, we basically have the equivalent of Eva Braun at, you know, the Winter Olympics. And, you know, people are so invested in their domestic political differences that they're swooning over her because that allows them to kick dirt at Michael Pence. I think that's shameful.
Well, thank you both for joining us today. Arvina Martin is a member of the Madison Common Council and former chair of the American Indian Caucus for the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. And Rick Essenberg there with us, president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. This edition of Week in Review was produced by Bill Martins. We had technical direction from Dean Kennetter. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. Have a great weekend.